ahead and when I was asked what topic I wanted to talk about today, I said I wanted to talk about dana, about generosity, because in the insight tradition, instructions on generosity are often squashed down into a dana talk, which is actually a fundraising talk. And I think that's doing a real disservice to this foundational teaching of the Buddha. But I want to start with a non-Buddhist story about generosity. So once upon a time, there were two brothers, William and Angus, and they were given land on condition that they turn it into a productive farm within a year. And they got to the land where they were going to live and looked it over and saw the thin, rocky soil and said, well, we may with hard work keep body and soul together, but we'll never be rich. This is what we have to do, so let's do it. And whether the work was took, whether the days were long or short, they're short to tell about, but eventually their first harvest day came, and they started harvesting the barley and binding it into sheaves. And being fair-minded men, they divided everything 50-50. They stacked half of the sheaves along William's side of the barn and half of the sheaves along Angus's side of the barn. But as William was cleaning the tools, Angus said to himself, you know, it's really not fair that we're dividing things 50-50. I mean, I only have myself to worry about, but my brother, his wife and children are going to join him as soon as we're really established. I won't say anything to him. I'll just take some of my barley sheaves and put them on his side of the barn. So he did that. And while Angus was cooking, William said to himself, you know, it's not fair that we divide everything 50-50. I mean, I've got my children to care for me in old age, but my brother is on his own. So I'm not going to say anything to him. I'll just take some of the barley sheaves from my side of the barn and move them to his side of the barn. And this went on every day of the harvest, and both of them scurrying around on their errands of generosity, until on the last day they finally ran into each other as they were doing the switch. And after they finished embracing each other and crying, they decided that they were going to invite everybody to all their neighbors to a celebratory dinner, because they discovered that they were in fact rich. They were rich enough to share, and they were rich in each other's love. So this instinct for sharing is something that is so deeply human. This is you know, when my brother was in Beavers as part of his progress through Boy Scouts, they had this little chant, sharing, sharing, sharing. You know, this is not a sophisticated concept. And I think that's part of why we can rush over it to things that seem more intellectually compelling. But this is something that the Buddha always, always, always taught when he was speaking to a new audience. And, you know, as was his wont, he broke it down into different kinds of giving, different motivations for giving, to come up with some really detailed, specific instructions for how to give and why. So just defining terms for a sec, the word dana refers to the act of giving and also to the thing given. It's related to the word chaga, which is the inner feeling of generosity, and also the act of relinquishment or letting go. So giving can be associated with generosity, and it can also not be associated with generosity. And it's giving that the Buddha emphasized in his teachings on dana. This act and this feeling strengthen each other. The giving even if it doesn't start out being motivated by generosity, can weaken the greed that blocks those feelings of generosity. So there's different kinds of gifts. There's the first gift is a broad category, including money, material things, and your time and attention. So sharing food, making donations to charities, choosing thoughtful gifts, giving material things thoughtfully involves understanding what's welcome. So my family has a tradition of bacon and egg sandwiches on festive occasions, and whenever we have people who don't eat bacon staying with us, and my father always cooked these sandwiches. That was his role. And without question, whenever we had somebody who didn't eat bacon staying with us, he would always just come up with an alternative. If what I was initially going to give isn't welcome, fine, I'll give something else. So this first category of material things, like I said, includes your time, your effort. So helping people move or volunteering can be an act of giving. How you give your attention can also be an act of giving. How you relate in conversation. Are you really wholeheartedly present? And what I was prompting at the beginning of the meditation is this curiosity about what would it be like to be fully present for myself? What would it be like to be generous with my attention to whatever my circumstance is in this moment? And in this cycle in this realm of giving, receiving is also part of that equation. The Pali word for monastic, bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, it translates as beggar. It means a mendicant, one who lives on alms food. And it's seen as noble to ask for support, because if you don't ask, you're not giving people an opportunity to connect. I think for a lot of us, giving just feels so much more comfortable than receiving, and the vulnerability of letting people know your needs can be intimidating at first, but it allows them to have a deeper relationship with you. The second category of giving is giving freedom from fear by acting with integrity. It's said that the bliss of blamelessness is the highest happiness that's available to householders. The ability to look back without remorse on your past actions is a really beautiful, beautiful form of happiness. This giving of freedom from fear is related to generosity, to loving kindness, also to wisdom, the understanding that no happiness that depends on the unhappiness of others can be stable and satisfying. This willingness to value others' happiness as highly as one's own. And the third form of generosity is the third kind of thing you can give is the gift of the Dhamma. It's called the supreme gift, and it's also the only gift that shouldn't be given unasked. The Buddha built in safeguards against giving unwanted advice. His instructions to his monastics was always to teach where they're invited. And the traditional relationship of teacher and student was one of mutual support. It's a village would support a monastic so that their livelihood was taken care of. Their clothes were, you know, if the villagers saw that the monastic's robe was getting tatty, they'd at the next appropriate time give them a new robe. If they saw their thatched hut, the roof was leaking, they'd find some new straw and rethatch the hut, so that the monastic would have time to focus on practice, and when they were invited to teach without, you know, putting out a tip jar. So this sense of the two kinds of people supporting each other, the lay people supporting the monastic materially, and then the monastic supporting the lay community with the gift of Dhamma. Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about this, this concept of reciprocity as the idea that every being has a gift. That gift and responsibility are two sides of the same coin. The strawberry was given the gift of juicy red sweetness. It was also given the responsibility to feed us. So asking how we participate in reciprocity is asking, what is our responsibility? But it's also asking, what is our gift? What is the gift of the human people? That's what we are called to give in reciprocity, in return for everything we've been given. More often than not, in return for everything we have taken. Each of us has a different gift, as a parent, a teacher, an artist, a gardener. Whatever your gift is, we're called to give it in return for everything we've been given. So the Buddha had instructions on who we should give to. So it's sort of, there's two big categories here. One is to give where you think your gift will be put to good use. So if you can tell that, in the Buddha's context, if you can tell that a is really sincere in their practice and is devoting themselves to making the most of this opportunity to deepen in wisdom and compassion, and living in a way that's inspiring to see, that's somebody you might choose to give to. In a modern context, I do this kind of giving when I research charities, like how different charities use money that I might give to them. Do I approve of the purpose for which they're using it? And do I see that they're taking appropriate care of the resources they've been entrusted with? So that's one kind of way to decide who to give to. And the other way to decide is just where your heart feels inspired. Tanjef Tanisaro Bhikkhu, the Thai forest monastic, talks about meeting with a potential donor who was coming on retreat, and he was saying, you know, I'm just really feeling like I need to be more generous in my life, and I'm not sure where to direct my gifts. And Tanjef said, oh, give where you feel inspired. And instead of saying, oh yeah, definitely give to us. And so the person thought it over and gave to like an arts organization instead of the monastery. And you know, Tanjef said, that's great. Like that's where his heart was called to give. And I wasn't coercing him into giving to just me. So to see where your heart feels called to contribute is a really beautiful thing to bring to generosity. Not so much calculating, is this gift going to be optimized? So just this sense of the heart overflowing with generosity. And of course, the Buddha had instructions on how to give. One that strikes me as the most the most impactful, I guess, is the instruction to give without harming oneself or others. And this is different from an ideal of self-sacrifice. You know, to see one's own well-being as important as anybody else's, not putting it above others as sometimes we do in selfishness, and one's own well-being as any less important than anyone else's. One of the signs that giving and receiving have been unbalanced can be burnout. You know, if this is something that I've had to contend with at a number of times in my life, just feeling like ways I was spending my time, the purposes I was using my effort on, weren't nourishing my heart in the way that would make my that use of my time sustainable, or the in some other way the balance of giving and receiving was off. And so when there's this sense of being overextended, sometimes it's appropriate to give less, to step back, to see one's own well-being as worthy of care. To not have this I don't know, in the most compassionate people, there can often be this gap in compassion when it comes to oneself, to see getting overextended as a sign that you care, and to really be willing to look carefully at that. Like, does it serve anybody if I'm, you know, burnt out and resentful? Probably not. So can I make my own well-being a priority, even as I'm really pouring out all of my energy in service to a cause I care about? The Buddha said, from little, one should give little. From much, give much. Of giving nothing, no question can arise. So to have this sense of tuning your giving to your means. Don't give away the rent money, right? And to have that sense of potential around, in one way or another, whether in money or other material resources or in time, I do have abundance right now. And so maybe I can share a lot. Maybe I can take on a big project or make a big financial donation that will enable some cause I care about to flourish. But to see the attitude with which one gives as being the most important thing. It's the instruction on giving is to be happy before you give, anticipating the opportunity to exercise generosity. While giving, to be happy to make another person happy by fulfilling a need. And after giving, to be satisfied in having done a good deed. And so that feeds into a list of different motives for giving. There's they're kind of ranked. So you could give, like I said before, giving isn't always an expression of generosity. It can be an expression of many different things with different outcomes for the giver. You could give as an insult. I don't know if you remember at the beginning of Lord of the Rings, Bilbo gives a stationery set to somebody who was really bad at returning letters, and a mirror to somebody he thought was a bit too vain. So, you know, you could give a gift as a deliberate insult, and that would be one motivation for giving. You can give motivated by fear. So a bribe is a gift motivated by fear. You could give as a way of returning a favor. There's this sense of they did something for me, so I have to do something for them. You could give as a way of currying favor, so in hopes of getting something similar back. So there's an agenda, there are strings attached to that kind of gift. You could give to get a reputation for being generous. You know, you look at buildings named after the donors that supported their construction, that could be that kind of giving. You could give because giving is good. Just the sense of the heart aligning with giving. You could give to help other people out of this desire for other people's well-being. And what's interesting to me is that's not seen as the highest motivation for giving. In the Buddhist schema, the highest motivation is to adorn and beautify the mind. So being able to look back on your own generous actions leads to a joyful, contented mind, which leads to calm and insight. This is a... In the Buddhist schema, the best gift you can give is to become fully awakened, because then you're always going to be showing up with wisdom and compassion. And so having this kind of tranquility of mind to support practice as a fruit of giving is seen as actually being the best reason to give in this schema. And of course, there's advice for how to give. So giving what's welcome. When I was a teenager, my best friend's mother was dying very slowly and painfully of cancer. And my family had moved across the province recently. And late in the summer, I went to visit her. And I could tell that having another teenager in the house cheered her up and was helpful to her in some way. And so as we were driving back across the province, I was telling my dad in my like self-important 15-year-old way that I really wanted to go back sometime during the fall and spend more time with her. And you know, I think my father had a more realistic assessment of the likely progress of my friend's mother's illness than I did. And he just said, you know, you need to understand the difference between what you want to give and what she needs. You know, it may be that at that time she'll need quiet and privacy. And so even though you want to give her your presence, that may not be welcome. And yeah, that in that moment, that kind of snapped me out of that self-centered approach to giving because I wanted to give rather than looking at what was welcome to her. There's, you know, it's important to take care with what you give, that that you're giving what is welcome, what can be used. There, a major problem that charities that collect used clothing have is sorting through all of the donations of things that really should just be recycled. There, and I'm happy that nowadays there's more opportunities to recycle fabric. The other teachings on giving are that donations should be given in a way that the recipient does not feel humiliated or belittled or hurt. To give with care for how the receiver will feel included. And the other instruction on giving is to give with one's own hand, to have a face-to-face connection with the recipient. It creates a sense of connection. In this way, the act of giving can strengthen communities. There's a movement called Buy Nothing. There's neighborhood groups. There's one in my neighborhood, and I've received a loaf of bread. I've given away my mom gave me not one but two wall calendars for some reason. I don't use wall calendars, but they were very pretty, so I found new homes for them. And this sense of giving and receiving to people in my neighborhood makes me feel like I belong here. This is a place where I can contribute. And just yesterday, I saw an article on the Tricycle website about the Buy Nothing movement. And it turns out that it was actually inspired by Buddhist teachings, that one of the original founders first learned about Buddhism through a project in Nepal. And when she went back some years later with, you know, bags and bags filled with clothing and toys to give to the families, she and her friend were trying to divide everything appropriately. They were trying to decide who needs what and getting really into making appropriate stacks of clothing and toys for each household and making sure that the households with babies got the baby clothes. And as they were in the thick of this, the head of the community walked over and said, no, what are you doing? You should just divide it all evenly. And so, you know, a 68-year-old woman living alone ended up with baby clothes. And from the community's point of view, this was exactly right, because that would give her the opportunity to give a gift to somebody else in the community and to become a part of their family by that act of giving, to have a deeper connection. And so, you know, to come from this, this person is from the United States, and she was coming with this kind of idea of optimizing and getting everything just right and deciding in advance how everything should be, and to see that the community trusted that the community would be able to reallocate everything wisely, and by that act of reallocation to create a stronger community. And this act of giving, of sharing within your community or beyond, it counteracts the feeling of lack. If you have enough to share, then you're wealthy. If you don't have enough to share, then you're poor. You know, you read these stories of So I was reading about a Silicon Valley millionaire who had $64 million in the bank, and it wasn't enough because he knew people who had more. And it's so easy to get sucked into that mindset of not enough, no matter what your bank balance is. And just the act of giving something really simple, making somebody a sandwich, can help to loosen that sense of self-preoccupation. And at the same time, setting the intention to give can help to identify the areas in your life, in your heart, where you hold back, where you're afraid to give, where there's the sense of lack or the sense of reluctance around giving, where the blockages to generosity are. In this way, the practice of giving is a purification, in the same way as metta or loving kindness is. For those of you who've done extended periods of metta practice, you will have seen that what happens is you set the intention for loving kindness for this open, radiant heart. And what can come up is resentment or envy or fear. And that's all part of the practice. It's a mapping of the terrain of the heart. You can set the intention to have these beautiful qualities like generosity and kindness, and then just see, okay, what is it that blocks that? So to see the practice of giving as a tool for understanding what's the terrain of the heart right now. Where is it easy to give? Where is it hard to give? What kinds of things can I give? Maybe it's easy for me to give money, but hard for me to give attention. Maybe vice versa. And as we practice giving more and more, it can also loosen the sense of favoritism. So instead of being fixated on your people, your family, your friends, your coworkers, broadening it out to your community, to eventually to anyone who needs help, to give not because you, not just to strengthen relationships in your community, not just to help the people you care about, but just to give to anyone who needs help. And a form of giving that's very important to me is the dedication of merit. So at the end of a period of practice, to take all of the benefit of whatever practice you've done and just give it away. And why this is so important to me is not that I understand how it works at all. The mechanism is a big mystery to me, but the intention to share the merit is absolutely vital to keeping practice from being just another self-improvement project. In some cases, just another stick to beat yourself with, you know, to have meditation be something else to get right isn't super useful. We all have enough things on our to-do list. For me, the simple act of dedicating merit helps change the frame from, you know, I am improving, I am becoming more acceptable, to I'm giving a gift to the world. I'm offering this practice, this, I'm content to slog away and let others receive the benefits of this practice, because I want this practice to be a gift to the world, even if I don't really understand what that means. For me, this is it's just such a key to not getting hung up on outcomes. You know, when there's this sense of meditation is something I'm doing to get better at, you can have bad sits, right? Like a distracted sit is a bad sit. When there's this sense that my practice is just a gift to the world, any sit where there's that intention for presence is a good sit. And, you know, for people like me who have strong conditioning around over-efforting and over-evaluating, anything that helps nudge the practice in a more open, receptive direction is very helpful. So even if you haven't tried dedicating merit before, even if you don't, if merit isn't a concept that resonates for you, I'd invite you to experiment with it, you know, to, especially in these times when so many of us have been so much more isolated than we're used to being, to have this sense of at least the heart connecting with our community through this act of mysterious sharing, can keep the practice from becoming isolated or self-centered. You know, it can help to loose, and so this framework of giving, of sharing even one's own spiritual progress, can help to loosen the tendencies to self-absorption. So it's reframing from walking around wondering, am I a good person, to checking, is this action motivated by generosity or selfishness? And that change of frame of reference from evaluation, from self-preoccupation, even if it's phrased as self-improvement, to really getting interested in the motivation for one's actions is a very important step towards freedom. And of course, generosity is an expression of practice. Somebody who's entered the stream of practice is going to be relentlessly generous as well as unerringly ethical. People often ask, you know, how do I know if an enlightenment experience was genuine? And the way you tell is, how has it affected your relational life? You know, do you find yourself being more self-preoccupied or less? Do you find yourself being more generous, showing up more fully for the people in your life, more concerned for the integrity of your actions? Charlotte Joko Beck says, enlightenment is the ability to give totally in every second. It's not about having some great experience. Such moments may occur, but they don't make an enlightened life. We need to ask, what does it mean for me to give in this moment? When the phone rings, how can we give? When cooking, what does it mean to give totally? So please give, 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 and practice, practice, practice. It is the way. So I think I'm going to end there and see if there's any questions or comments or stories about times when you've been touched by other people's generosity. Just curious what's coming